What is up, Vermont Edition podcast listener? This is Elodie Reed, digital producer for VPR. Just to let you know, this podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Republican Lieutenant Governor candidate Scott Milne was scheduled to appear on our program today, but he canceled his appearance in an email Friday and declined an invitation to reschedule. You can hear interviews with Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor Molly Gray and progressive Democratic candidate for Governor David Zuckerman by visiting our website, vpr.org. This ends our series of one-on-one interviews with major party candidates for Lieutenant Governor and Governor of Vermont. Republican candidate for Governor Phil Scott was unable to find a date to appear on the program, and Chris Erickson did not respond to an invitation to participate. The unexpected opening in our schedule gave us a chance, though, to have a conversation we were worried we wouldn't have space for this year, given all the important political and COVID coverage we've been doing. We're going to get to have our annual Fall Bird Show after all. I'm very excited to welcome back naturalist and birding enthusiast Bridget Butler. Bridget, I wish we could be together in person, but it's nice to chat with you from afar. Thanks for being with us on short notice.
Oh, you know it. Always ready to talk birds. Jane, I have a picture of you up on my computer screen so I can feel like I'm still looking at you.
Oh, I should do the same. I hope it's a good one. Bridget, I mentioned in our billboard that, you know, I always keep an eye on the robins in our yard, but there's one in particular that we can always notice because it's kind of blonde. It's got, it's not an albino robin. It has a red breast, but it's got these sort of blonde feathers on its back. And so, you know, even as some robins stick around through the winter, we've noticed that this one tends to fly off. And so we notice when some of the robins leave because this one goes away. So what's happening with robins these days?
That is so awesome. Now, is this a bird that you have year after year? So you've seen it come and go multiple years?
Yes, it's been back for at least 2 or 3 years. And in fact, our neighbor just down the street and across the street sometimes texts us to say, she calls it Blanco. Oh. And she says, have you seen Blanco? I think it's mostly in your yard, but I haven't seen it in weeks and I'm really worried. And so we sort of have a neighborhood watch out for this bird.
Oh, that's so awesome. So robins are really kind of cool. They're a really easy bird to see. It's something that we're familiar with. And you and your neighbors have this unique opportunity because it's almost like you have one robin that's been tagged in a way by this, you know, it sounds leucistic, mm-hmm. like a set of feathers don't have that, the coloration in them. Mm-hmm. And robins are like medium to short distant migrants, which means they can still survive here during the winter. They tend to push into some of the Champlain Valley, the lowlands, places where there's lots of wild food, like wild grape and sumac and things like that. Winterberry is another really good one. So they're shorter distance migrants. So the robins that we see right now may not even be like, quote unquote, our robins. They might not be the breeding robins that we got to know through the spring and we watched them with their babies and all of that. So these may be robins that have pushed down from further north and they're just moving in response to the weather and where they're going to be able to find food. So it sounds like your Blanco robin is pushing on somewhere else. And so we can't always tell which robins are ours and which aren't, but you guys have that unique opportunity to do that.
Yeah, it's been very cool. And we are going to now have something to look forward to when spring comes, you know, just waiting and seeing if Blanco comes back. I'm not the only one asking about robins. Carol wants to know, what is with all the robins hanging around lately? So
yeah,
what's going on in Carol's neighborhood?
Yeah. So, you know, this is something that I teach in my slow birding classes, which is really watching different behaviors of birds and noticing those behaviors that might stand out as we move through the seasons. So one of the things that starts to happen to a number of different species during this time of year is they shift from being loners, right, and competitive about territory, because during the spring and summer, it's all about finding a mate and breeding. So there's this high sense of competition for space and for mates, to this gathering and coming together in order to survive. So we see this in robins as they're moving through their short distance migration, where they flock up together. So I've experienced this in my neighborhood too, where it can be absent of robins. And then a couple days later, all of a sudden it's like there are robins everywhere feeding in the neighborhood. And it's kind of that next wave of birds that are coming through. So I'm psyched that she noticed that. Yeah, that is something that you can watch for and notice on the landscape right now.
What,
Other birds
yeah,
that
what else
do
does that
that
besides
too.
robins?
Yeah, so crows, and I have the crow project that again, like this year, we can watch for crows roosting together at night. And I've already started to notice this late in the afternoon, groups of crows kind of starting to stream and come together. So during the breeding season, they're dispersed, they're more territorial. And now during this time of year, roosting together at night has lots of advantages in terms of warmth, in terms of avoiding predators, and also in terms of sharing knowledge about where good food sources are. So,
Bridget, do you have good ideas of where people can go see those crows? Because I know of a great there's like the crows all come back to roost in sort of downtown Middlebury area at night, which is really fun to see. I know there's some places in Burlington that people also observe crows. Other places around the state that you know of that people might, because it's so cool to see hundreds or thousands of crows all passing through the air at once and then listen to them settle down for the night.
Oh, it's raucous, right?
It is raucous, and now we've lost Bridget right in the middle of the crow conversation. We'll get her back. But listeners, what about you? Have you been seeing crow migrations, those nightly migrations, not the big crow migration, but the nightly migration to the roosting site? If that's something you've observed, it is pretty amazing to see. So let us know what you've been observing there. Our number is 800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also email vermontedition@vpr.org. You're going to have to indulge me while we get Bridget on a phone line here. So I'm going to tell you another story, which is that I was going for a morning run the other day and was listening to independent producer Erica Heilman's story on going through the corn maze, which was spooky and also pretty funny. If you haven't heard it, go to vpr.org and give it a listen. I loved listening to it, but I realized there was some sound coming from beyond my headphones as I was running past this cornfield and past a corner with woods. So I took off my headphones and realized it was just this huge flock of, I believe it must have been starlings. I couldn't get a close look at them, but they were moving from a cornfield into the trees. And I swear to you, they sounded like a bunch of saws or like creaky doors, not birds. So it sort of added to the spooky mood with Erica Heilman's story. But you can be done listening to my stories because I think we have Bridget Butler back on the line with us. Bridget, hi.
This happened last time too. You guys are so great. Sorry. Thank you.
Where we lost you had just said that listening to a murder of crows move into their roosting site is a raucous sound.
Yeah. And so as they move into the roosting area, they're calling out really, really loud. And that set of calls basically tells all the other birds where to come. So the way that we can find these is basically by finding the streaming birds that are streaming across the sky late in the day and following them to their roosting sites. So I got so many questions about this, like yours, like where are these roosting spots? And I didn't have the answer for them. So I started a project on iNaturalist called the Vermont Crow Project. So you can actually go to that site and you can pull up a map that shows probably, I think it's been going for 5 years now, where people are seeing these roosting sites. And you can upload your own sightings by basically snapping a picture and uploading it to that iNaturalist project, the Vermont Crow Project, and it will put a little pin on the map where you saw your crows. So it's been a really fun way to engage people with a late fall winter phenomenon that is, it's just so moving and cool to see. So I think this is one of the great things to kind of look forward to as we move into wintertime.
If you're on Twitter, listeners, I'm also going to tweet out a question for you now, a video of those birds that were moving through the trees and sounding like creepy saws instead of birds. And you can share with us where you see crows roost at night. I'll retweet them and maybe we can help some other people who haven't been able to have this experience find them. And Bridget, you can also send me the link for where people can find the crow listing project on iNaturalist. Let's go to Natalie, who's calling in from Charlotte. Hi, Natalie.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks. How about you?
Great, thank you. So my question is, is, what can I do to attract hummingbirds on my property in the spring, besides just hanging a hummingbird feeder? Like, are there specific plantings I could put in? And then the other side of the same question is, are there things that make them fearful, like wind chimes or, you know, stuff like that that I can avoid so that they want to come to my house?
So Natalie wants hummingbirds next spring. Bridget, what should she do?
You know, that's a great question. You know, so the thing that I always talk to people about is increasing the diversity of native plant species in your yard is the number one thing that you can do to attract birds to your backyard or your front yard or wherever you want to be able to see birds. So part of that, especially with if we start to think about hummingbirds, and this works for any bird, is we want food, water, shelter, and nesting habitat or places where that bird can build a nest. So when we start to get to know a bird a little bit better, we can kind of build this profile in our head about what birds like. So for hummingbird, that bird is a nectivore, but it's also, so it feeds on nectar, but it's also an insectivore. So they like spiders and other small insects that they can eat. So they get that protein from insects on your land as well. And when we plant native species, we encourage native insects that are there for the birds to feed on. So there's a couple ways we can think about that. We can think about planting more native plants that can provide nectar. So we can look at some of the different asters. We can look at bee balms. We can look at, I'm trying to think of what else I've seen my, and there are some like annuals that you can use as well. But verbena is another one. So planting flowers that are going to provide that nectar for the hummingbird is really important. And then just allowing things to get eaten. That's the other thing I think that's really hard for gardeners is to allow caterpillars and other insects to eat plants because they then provide protein for the birds. And then in terms of nesting, and I'm not sure if there's a preferred tree type for hummingbirds, but they like trees to be able to nest in where they're going to be able to build a nice cup nest. So trees that have branches that come out in a horizontal kind of fashion and have branching that will allow for a hanging cup nest. So there are some great resources out there, and I'll try to share some of those with you, Jane, so you can put them out for your listeners. But there's one that's a book that's called Trees, Shrubs, and Vines for Birds. And each tree, shrub, or vine, it kind of breaks down how different species of birds use that for food, nesting, or for shelter. So it's a really great resource to have as you garden and landscape on your property.
Ah, cool. Yeah, we have a lot of hummingbirds around by me, but I have never seen a nest in the summertime or even after the leaves go in the fall. So I'm desperate to find a hummingbird nest at some point.
I think that's all timing, like being in the right place at the right time, and then maybe even noticing different behaviors. Mm-hmm. You know, we were talking about the flocking behavior that happens during this time of year. One of the ways you can build a profile about a bird that you want to get to know is start looking at what are some of the behaviors that will tell me that this bird is nesting. So for example, in the spring, I look for birds carrying nesting material. I mean, if you saw a hummingbird zipping around with a little piece of lichen in its mouth, you'd be like, ooh, I need to follow that. Or spider webs. You're like, that bird's not eating that. That bird is going to go build a nest somewhere.
Well, or I gave my son a pandemic haircut this spring, and I remember as a child reading a book, it might have been Anne of Green Gables or something, where they left the hair clippings outside for the birds to get. And so we did the same, and then we actually found a nest at the end of the season that the whole inside is covered with my son's hair. So we brought that in, and
awesome.
It may sound a little weird to some people, but it was so cool to us because, you know, we did this thing and then the birds got to enjoy it. And then we found the nest. It was really magic. All right. So speaking of hummingbirds, though, Jessica wrote in to say, I saw a hummingbird yesterday here in Brandon, Vermont. Mm. So late. I couldn't see what species. It was drab colored and quick. Lost?
So one of the things we have to keep in mind is that there are birds to the north of us, right? And that sounds so basic, but then you're like, oh, yeah, all of those birds that are to the north of us have to migrate and move through. So there's a number of different factors that can affect whether or not a bird's going to be on time and keeping up with all the other birds that have decided to migrate as the as the light changes, right? They look at how the length of the day is. That's a big cue. And then food availability is another big cue for the birds that they have to leave and move. And I think one of the things that we forget is as long as the bird's finding food, they will continue to hang out. Well, not all into the winter, but hummingbirds can find the protein and some of the nectar sources as they continue to move south. We're not going to keep hummingbirds here by leaving our hummingbird feeders out, so we don't have to worry too much about that. And there have been stragglers that have been reported in past years that have stayed really late into the season. One of the things I like to do when I have questions like this that come up is I use this great resource called Vermont eBird. And what you can do is you can go online, and I've done it for a couple of birds for our talk today, but I didn't do it for hummingbird. But you guys can do it yourself. So go to Vermont eBird, and across the top of the menu bar, you'll see this feature called Explore. And if you type the name of the bird in and you tweak the dates to, like, the current date around maybe do August through November, and then you type in Vermont, what it's going to do is it's going to give you a map with all these little points of where people have reported that specific species of bird. And that's how I find out the answers to questions like hers. So you can do it yourself and figure out how late this hummingbird that I may have seen is based on what other people are seeing across the state. And then you can zoom out and look across the region, which I think is really cool, because sometimes then you can see the waves of movement as you change the dates and refresh your web page.
Hmm, that sounds so cool. I will say, Bridget, one year I had a hummingbird we had left out our feeders, which, you know, I guess we shouldn't, not because it'll keep the birds around, but just because the birds aren't there anymore. But we had still left out our feeders and saw a hummingbird. And Kent McFarland and others looked at my pictures and said, "That's a rufous hummingbird.
Yes.
They're in the Rockies. They don't belong here." And so we think it may have been blown off course. But before any of the naturalists could flock to our feeder, it was gone again. But that was a pretty cool sighting, because it was a hummingbird that we don't have in Vermont.
Yeah, I remember that. And so that's the other piece to pay attention to, are the weather patterns. So if we get big storms that can blow different species in, that's a cue, especially to birders, that they want to go out and look for the possibility for different species. And then think about good weather, too, on those good weather days, especially evenings when a lot of these songbirds are migrating, when it's cooler and easier on their bodies because they're generating so much energy flying. We want to see winds coming out of the north and pushing to the south. And so when you have those nice, clear nights like that with a good, like a gentle wind from that direction, that's going to be a really great migrating night for birds.
Let's go to Victor, who's calling in from Worcester. Hi, Victor.
Hey, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, go right ahead.
All right. Listen, I loved your short piece on robins and the Blanco. And it reminded me of a question I've had. I've watched my robins. We're a little high. I'm at 1,200 feet altitude toward the mountains. And I noticed this year for the first time, as these vast groups of familiar robins begin to dissipate into fewer and fewer, I've noticed this year that the robins that remain look, I know they are very, very young. I mean, some of them still have spots. I mean, they're big and fat, but and I'm just asking, are they left behind? I mean, does everybody leave and they're basically left fitting for themselves?
Huh. Victor, that's so interesting. Yeah, what do you think, Bridget?
That is a really super observation. I love that. So, you know, Victor's talking about how these young juvenile first-year robins, right, have spots on them when they're first born. And so we have later broods that are coming through. So it's kind of, they're not all in sync in terms of molting, but their red feathers will come in before the winter time. So they kind of grow in and over those spotted feathers, which is really kind of cool. That's something I learned this year as I was asking the same types of questions about robins in my yard. So what tends to happen with some different species, this actually happens with loons too, it's kind of like the adult experienced birds know to move first, right? And this is why robins also form these flocks. And so they kind of aggregate together and they know that this is time to move. And the younger first year birds are going to be hanging out with those flocks that have come together in order to follow the lead of the more mature birds and leave that space. So I think you will see some birds that seem like stragglers. Again, this might be birds from further north from us that are moving into the area. And just kind of, it's a little bit, little sections of waves. Think about them as waves of birds that kind of come through, especially those if they're coming down at night and resting and relaxing. They're grouping up, they're feeding together, and then they're moving on at night again.
Cool. Hey, I think we have another robin comment or question while we're talking robins. Jim is calling in from West Burke. Hey, Jim.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks. You've seen robins or have a question about robins?
Yes, I have an observation and a sad story. For the second time in 2 years, the robins decided to build a nest on my porch, on my cabin, in the window box.
Oh, Jim, we can't hear you. I'm going to come back to you, so sit tight or call us back if you've got a landline or a better line or better area for reception there in West Burke, because I want to hear your story. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this while we see if we can get Jim with a better signal.
Yeah.
Naomi in Burlington says, I have a woodpecker that thinks the best place to look for insects is in the eaves of my house.
Yeah.
It is leaving large troughs that it has drilled in the wood. Is there some way to discourage it? Or is it actually doing me a favor by removing the bugs?
Oh, it might be doing you a favor, but driving you crazy at the same time. I remember living in a house that had cedar shakes on it, and the woodpeckers drilled multiple holes trying to get at different insects that had, you know, moved up under the shingle, especially for the wintertime. I think there are some different things you can try. I've tried flagging tape before, long strips of flagging tape near the spot where the woodpeckers are feeding, that may blow in the wind or be a visual distraction for them. You can try one of those plastic owls. Sometimes putting something that seems like a predator in the area works. Even something that is out of the ordinary, right? So if you disrupt that space, that visual space that woodpecker is normally used to, it's going to see it as an odd object and be suspicious of it. That may only last for a few days, but at least it'll be a few days rest. With food in there, they're gonna go after that food. So try some different things. I know there are some inflatable, they're like these big eyes. Berry farmers use them. Mm-hmm. Blueberry and strawberry patch owners will put up these inflatable, bright yellow, almost like a balloon that has like a dark eye painted on it. And that can sometimes keep them away as well.
That would keep me away.
Yeah, well, and it'll go good with your Halloween decor right now, too. So, I don't know, put a scary ghost or a witch or one of those giant 60-foot skeletons up there. You'll be all set.
Before we try coming back to Jim again, I think we have another woodpecker question from James in Burlington. Hi, James.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Thank you. I'm good. I'm glad that somebody else had a woodpecker question because I thought it was going to be. Anyways, so about 25 years ago, my father and I were outside. I grew up in Burlington and saw this really, really large woodpecker. I mean, he was probably 16 inches in length, and that wasn't really including his tail. And he kind of had that sort of characteristic cartoonish Woody Woodpecker look, you know, a big, huge sort of triangular plumage on his head.
Nice.
And so I was curious. I did a little bit of research and found a name called Opileated Woodpecker. Now, I don't know if that was one of those or, and I have only seen one of those types one other time. Hmm. So maybe you could shed some light on that.
Yeah, your description is wonderful. Yeah, really large bird, probably bigger than a blue jay size, close to crow size. Pileated woodpecker is the largest woodpecker that we have here in our region. And both the male and the female have that nice red woody woodpecker kind of crest on the top of the head. They're around... I can't remember the number that you just threw out, but I think you were pretty close. They're about 16 inches in length, so it is a very big bird. And they are fairly common. They're going to be common in Vermont where there's good food sources for them. So this is where there's wooded areas with dead or dying trees that they can find food in, insects in, and then also build their cavity nests in as well. So that's pretty awesome. I do hope you get a chance to see more of them because they are out and about. And they'll stay here through the winter, too, which is great.
And they're remarkable. I mean, I still remember the first time as a kid that I got to see a pileated woodpecker up close. When you first see them up close, Bridget, boy, it's like seeing a prehistoric creature. They're fascinating.
They are. They just take us right back. The other thing that I love when I see them is like when they're in flight, especially, and they come and they have that little bit of a swoop over. Mm-hmm. And the big white patches underneath the wing. So if you see something big that goes over that has these nice bright wing patches, bright white wing patches, you've probably got yourself a pileated woodpecker in the neighborhood.
Let's see if Jim in Westbrook has a good signal right now. Jim, hi. Thanks for sticking with us.
Hi, I'm outside now. can you hear me better?
Yeah, for now. So tell us, you had a sad story about a robin, you said.
Yeah. Right, they laid it, made a nest right outside my window box on my little cabin, and it's the second time, but this time they actually finished the nest off, and then she came one day, just like she's supposed to, 11 o'clock in the morning, laid an egg every day, and on the fourth day, it was Mother's Day. Well, the first day she laid the egg, it went down to 25 degrees, and I said that, and she never came back, and I said, that egg has got to be cooked, it's got to be frozen, and she did that the second day, and it got really cold, And the last day was Mother's Day, and she laid the last egg, and then she started sitting on the nest. And then I had to sneak around my cabin because she could see me through the window, and she'd fly off the nest. So for a week, I put a piece of cardboard by the window so I wouldn't scare her. But every time I went in and out, she'd leave the nest, and I was so afraid that the eggs wouldn't hatch because she didn't spend enough time there. But they finally did hatch. I think three of them came out. It's kind of hard to tell when they first come out. And then about 2 days after that, she couldn't find anything. The ground went from being frozen to being incredibly dry. And after about 3 days, I found the nest on the ground. A cat or a raccoon had gone after it, and the mom was gone. One or two of them survived. And I just seen an oriole. It's right now. Beautiful red bird.
Live birding. Jim, that's so cool. Jim, thank you for sharing that story. It's so hard. I think, Bridget, there may be other people like Jim. I mean, Jim had these robins right outside of his cabin window, and so he could observe them. But for a lot of Vermonters, I think, who were staying home this spring, perhaps more than usual, or maybe doing some parent teaching for the school year with their kids, there was a lot more time to observe things like nesting and what happened. And so for a lot of people, they also saw that a lot of fledglings don't make it.
Yeah, it's rough. I mean, and as I was listening to his story, I was remembering we had a robin this spring, too, that we got to watch as a family nest over a light right in the backyard. And we went through many of those same things where it's like, how can we avoid the area so we're not disturbing? Wondering if the female was getting enough time on the nest. The snow that came, the late snow that came, I was just like, oh, no, the poor. But she fledged. We had four fledglings as well. And once they fledged, they disappeared. And, you know, so then the questions start flowing about where did they go? You know, why aren't they right in the yard right away feeding? And it was really wonderful to be able to follow all the way through. And it gets intense, too. We had crows that would come every day and try to distract the female off the nest. So one would sit on the roof. Another one would sit in a tree nearby and get right in her face, hoping that the one, she would fly off the nest and the other one could come in and grab a nestling or an egg. And what was great is my kids have crow sticks now. They have these short little sticks that they have on the back porch. And so anytime they heard the crows, they would run out there with the crow sticks and bang them together to scare the crows off. So I understand the attachment and the drama, definitely, of watching nesting birds.
Yeah, me too. And certainly for a lot of people, it was sort of the entertainment this year.
Yeah.
Bridget, Dan in Brattleboro wrote in to say, I'm a forester, and on a brief lunch break in the woods of Newfane last week, while I was being very still and quiet, a very slow wave of maybe a few hundred juncos came through where I was sitting. They were foraging, and they didn't think anything of me. All those birds together made some noise, and as they slowly passed through, it was very cool to watch them forage up close.
Mm.
Isn't that neat?
Gosh, what a magic moment. You know, that. So he's like sitting in the woods, like eating lunch. This is like slow birding, perfect, like good connection here. So, you know, sitting still in one spot, sometimes you get these magic moments like this. So juncos are one of those, another fall phenomenon bird that I love to get excited about and get other people looking for. So this bird breeds in the higher elevation woodlands during the summertime, and that's where they spend their summers, right? And then they're also a short distance migrant too. So they migrate from higher elevations into lower elevations. And they're going to do this flocking up together as well and move to these lower elevations and spaces in the Champlain Valley or the Connecticut River Valley. And I waited and waited. This October, it was like, when are they going to get here? When are they going to get here? And other people were having them pop up in their yard. And I think I probably was a week or two behind some other folks. But I just think about that spine of the Green Mountains and how those birds are going to flow off of either side and come down into the lowlands. And, of course, it's going to take them a little bit longer to reach me out on the edge of Lake Champlain there in St. Albans City. But there's a beautiful little black and white bird, black kind of slate gray on the top, white belly. They have a little delicate small seed-eating beak that's kind of like a pinkish, pale pinkish color. And you will see them on the ground outside, especially if you have feeders out right now. And the note, the sounds, he mentioned the sound too. So vocalizations and the soundscape that we're used to changes during the fall as well. And what I've been trying to train my ear to listen to is try to tell the difference between these different call notes rather than songs that the birds are singing in order to stay in touch with one another. So chickadees do that chickadee-dee-dee thing to stay in touch with one another when they're feeding in a mixed flock. And sparrows and juncos have little sips and seeps and psh sounds that they make in order to stay in touch with one another. So you're going to get a little bit of visual candy and a little bit of audio candy there as well if you take a little bit of time to hang out on the landscape and see what's there during this time of year.
Let's go to Leona, who's calling in from Bennington. Hi, Leona.
Hi,
go right ahead.
I am so excited. I have so many stories, and you're the perfect person to tell it to. But I don't know where to start first. I have so many stories. So if I could just talk really fast and tell you briefly a little of all of them, but you've got to hear the Castleton one. It's absolutely phenomenal.
Wait, Leona, pick one. Pick one story, and then don't speed through it. Tell it slowly. We want to savor it.
Okay.
I mean, not super slowly. You know what I mean.
You have to hear the Castleton one before we hang up. But okay. I just wanted you to know, when I was little, I always was curious where the crows go at night because I could see them taking off for somewhere. And I wasn't even in school yet, and this has been bugging me with curiosity my entire life. And I happened to move to the very street where they roost at night, and it's so exciting. And I've been going out the past three nights and watching hundreds of them just swirling over my house. And I talk to them. I go, ah! I talk to them. And it's just amazing. They've cut down two or three of the really tall trees that were their favorite. But they still come to the street, and they will still fly over where the other tree used to be.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And they gather in a big group, and then they kind of go to one tree, and then part of them says, okay, see you later, and goes to another tree because the trees aren't big enough for all of them. But they used to all roost together in the one tree.
Yeah.
And one time, in the winter time, I woke up about 3 in the morning, and it was blizzarding out, and all these crows, this is when they were in this big tree right across from my bedroom across the street, and they were just flying around in this blizzard above their tree. It was amazing. And they were talking, and they were making all these great sounds talking to each other. But I got to tell you the Castleton story. I was up there for a course, and we had done a sleepover at Castleton College, and I got up early about 5:36 to go for a walk. And I don't know if it was about 6 or 6:30, but I heard crows, and it was something unusual. And I could see crows coming one, two, in a line from here, and then I look over here, and there's a same thing, and the line comes that direction. Look over here. It's like I'm in the center of a clock, and all these lines of crows are converging. So I followed the line of crows. I walked in that direction, and it got louder and louder. And I followed it, and it was close enough that they were landing all in these trees, and they were screaming and yelling. And I looked and looked, trying to figure out what was going on. And then I saw this beautiful, purpley shiny, young, large, huge crow that was dead. And I think one of those big trucks had hit it.
Yeah.
It was on the side of the road. And they came together, hundreds and hundreds of them. And they kept coming, and they kept coming until the trees were filled with them. And I was just transfixed that I could be part of this. And I just stood silently witnessing it.
I bet you were, Leona. That sounds amazing. And Bridget, boy, what a sight to see, although sad, but interesting to see these other birds. And we won't anthropomorphize them to say they were grieving or mourning or even necessarily noting the death of a fellow crow, but that there was some kind of energy and activity around this event.
Yeah, and there's been some really great research that has come out recently on what, well, I'm going to anthropomorphize it a little bit, crow funerals. And I'm trying to remember her last name. There's a woman who's got a PhD, and she studies corvids. She's out west. And I follow her online, and her name is just, oh, there, Kaylee Swift popped in all of a sudden. I'm like, yes. So Kaylee Swift, she studies crows, and she, one of her projects for her PhD was to study this whole thought of funerals. And so I'm not going to go into it too much. I'll leave it to you guys to do a little bit of research on it, but there's a lot more there happening. So there is a phenomenon where the crows will come together when they find a dead crow. And there's a number of other things that happen, and they are of a somewhat sexual nature, if I can leave it there. So fabulous research that is pretty new that is talking about what's going on when there are crow funerals.
Wow, yes. So there's your homework, listeners. You can read up on crow funerals. Mary in Plainfield wants you to say something about viewing snow geese. When, where, and how?
Okay, so snow geese, right? This is a really wonderful time of year to get excited about these guys. This is one that I did pull up a map for, Jane. So here's what's great. We're moving into the time when we're having snow geese. This is this large white goose about the size of a Canada goose. They're migrating from the Arctic tundra, and they come down the St. Lawrence Seaway, and then they follow Lake Champlain and sometimes the Connecticut River down further south. To where they're going to be spending the winter in the southern United States. And we have big staging areas of them. There's one in Addison. That's the traditional one that lots of us have gone to. That is along, what is that, Route 17? Do I have that right? Yeah,
yeah.
Route 17 and the Dead Creek Wildlife Management Area. Mm-hmm. So right now, Dead Creek, over the weekend, there have been reports from between 300 and 800 birds at the viewing platform there, and then on some of the different roads, if you drive some of the back roads there, you'll also find them in some of the cornfields there. I think the hot spot for snow geese the past few years has really been on the New York side of the lake, around the Kings Bay area, from anywhere from Plattsburgh up to the border. So there's all these really nice little bays and inlets there. They tend to leave corn in the fields a little bit longer, so the birds are picking up on that food source. And so we're seeing tens of thousands of birds on that side of the lake compared to hundreds here in Vermont. It used to just be the opposite. So here's the tricky part now, Jane, and you can, gosh, give your feedback on this. Right now, the counties where it's best to see the snow geese on the New York side of the lake have actually popped due to COVID. So they are red and yellow right now. So one of the things, I mean, I like to do annually is take my kids to see those birds, because you can drive Route 9 and get very close to the edge of the water, the bays where these birds are, and see them much closer than you can down in Addison County. But right now, I got to play it safe. This is like non-essential travel, right? It's not work-related. And so while I would really, really like to take my kids over there to where, and they're just beginning right now, they're still in the 500s in the Kings Bay area and the fields there, I got to wait until those counties go green again just to be on the safe side of things.
Yeah, sadly so. I think that's absolutely right, Bridget. And you know, especially right now, let's all do everything we can to stay safe. But there are ways that people can do some safe socializing around birds. You have a book club, and then there are also ways that people can get out into the woods and fields this winter.
Sure. You know, so online, you know, a lot of my business, and we talked about this in the spring, my business has shifted online, and I've been teaching slow burning classes, which I will kick off with a bunch of new ones in 2021. And it's been really a great way to connect with people actually all over the country and teach them this different approach to birding, where it's not so much chasing and listing, but really getting to know the birds that are closer to you. So some of the things that I've been doing, right, so slow burning allows me to, like, let go of listing and enjoy the birds right in my backyard. So I've been doing a lot of that. Other things that have worked for birders, and some groups are doing bird walks in very small groups. It is still fairly challenging because we can't share scopes or binoculars. Those of us who wear glasses struggle with fogging and our masks, so that can be really difficult. But there are, if you have a pod of people that you've been in contact with through this, you know, you've created that little COVID pod for yourself, I think there are ways that you can travel together and go birding. I have a couple of friends that I do this with right now. We don't take cars together. We don't share our equipment. We try to pack food when we can so that we're not making stops in other places. And we spread out along the trail or wherever we are so that we're giving each other enough space. Some other things that we're getting excited about over again that I haven't done in a really long time is something like Project Feeder Watch, which is through the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. So I'm...
You know what? We actually got a note from Bob who says, with so many people at home and taking up birding for the first time, please remind them they can add to the science by joining Feeder Watch, a free program of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, which starts in 3 weeks on Saturday, November 14th. So tell us more, Bridget.
That's it. So this is a really great project where you set a day, a week that you're going to watch. You watch for 20 minutes or more, and you enter your data into the website for scientists to be able to understand what's happening with winter birds across the landscape. And speaking of winter birds, don't forget the winter finch forecast. Jane, there's birds showing up across the United States that have not pushed this far down into the U.S. before. And I'm talking about pine siskins this year and evening grosbeaks, those incredibly robust black and yellow fat-beaked birds that will come and gobble up all the seed at your feeder. So people are already reporting sightings of these birds. Unfortunately, I don't have them in my yard yet. There is a big gap in northwestern Vermont for sightings of pine siskins, but I'm seeing lots of them from other parts of the state. So look up winter finch forecast. I'm sure Jane will grab that and we'll get that out to people. You can find that from me on Facebook as well. But it's really a great way to change your focus, use birds as a way to, I don't know, occupy your time, relieve some stress, and bring some joy into your life as well right now.
Well, I think we just have a brief moment here for Zach Cota, who's calling in from the North Branch Nature Center as well, while we talk about activities this winter. Oh. Hi, Zach. We've just got a minute.
Hi. To both of you, I just wanted to update about the annual Christmas bird count. A few of our dedicated community scientists have been asking whether or not it is going to happen this year. And the short answer is, yes, there will be a Christmas bird count, and the Audubon Society, who has run this program for now 121 continuous years, has put out some guidance for the local coordinators and how to keep counts safe for all of the participants. So if you would like to help with the annual Christmas bird count, you can go on to the National Audubon Society webpage and search for Christmas bird count. And there you'll find contact information for your local coordinators, and you can let them know that you're interested.
Zach, thanks very much. We'll get information about that up on our webpage at vpr.org as well. And Bridget, you know, one of the things that I know you love and I wish I had more time for is just sort of sitting in a sit spot, as you call it, in your own yard with a cup of coffee or whatever and watching the birds around you, which I think we could all do.
Yeah. It's been a really nice way to kind of step outside of things. I bring a journal with me. I mean, this is, we were hearing from different people about different things that they're noticing and seeing. I think there's a lot to absorb and connect with right outside our door that we often think of as the familiars. And we talked today about how some things are going to shift and change and other stuff that we can look for and enjoy when it comes to birds. So I hope people take that time to step right outside your door, spend a little bit of time slowing down and connecting with what's right around you, because there's an awful lot there.
Well, that's the naturalist and bird diva, Bridget Butler. Bridget, what a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks so much, Jane. Thanks, everybody, for joining us today, too.